Welcome to the first podcast from the Royal College of General Practitioners Essential Knowledge Updates team. We thought it would be a good idea to produce a short multimedia offering that would accompany the release of EKU 6. My name is Dirk Pilat and I'm a GP in the East End of London, and I have been the Essential Knowledge Update Development Fellow for the Royal College of General Practitioners since 2008. For this podcast, we asked some of our authors to comment on the topics they prepared for EKU 6 and what sort of applicable knowledge morsels they discovered whilst working on the content. As you might have read on the college's online learning environment website, EKU is released every 6 months after an extensive search for the most important papers and guidelines that present new and changing knowledge applicable for general practice. The topics that make it into the final update are chosen by an editorial board of 10 general practitioners. The topics that are deemed to be important enough to be major items are then being handed over to the individual authors, who then extract the most important points for day-to-day general practice in cooperation with myself. The finished modules are then being handed over to the editorial board, who scrutinize the content and, if necessary, make requests for editorial changes. After these changes have been implemented and checked, the director for e-learning of the college reviews the release and, when satisfied, signs the content off for release. Using this multi-layered approach to designing our content, the EKU team does ensure that we provide you with topics that were chosen, produced, and scrutinized by GPs, ensuring that the essential knowledge updates are tailor-made for day-to-day general practice. But now to our first author, who worked on the giant cell arteritis module. Louise, would you be so kind to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Louise Newson. I'm a GP in Solihull, West Midlands.
And you do have some experience in medical journalism, don't you?
Yes, I do. I write quite extensively for, mainly for GP magazine, but I've done quite a lot of work for the college in the past and written quite a lot of evidence-based medicine material too.
And can you remind us, please, what the paper was that you've written on for EKU 6?
It was the British Society of Rheumatology and British Health Professionals in Rheumatology guidelines on the management of giant cell arthritis, which has recently been published.
And was that a joy to transfer to an EKU?
I thought it was good. Obviously, giant cell arthritis is not something that we commonly see in practice, but it is something that we commonly think about when people come with headaches. So it was a really good reminder just to have an overview, how to diagnose it, how to assess patients, and then also about referring as well, because you always worry, should I be referring these people or just treating them with steroids myself? So, I enjoyed doing it.
And what were the key messages that you are going to be taking home with?
The really important things are, there's a few messages. One of them is that people with giant cell arthritis don't always have to have a raised ESR and CRP. And I know many doctors believe that you have to wait for your blood results before you start treating, and that certainly isn't the case. So treating, if you've got a high index of suspicion, to treat them very quickly. The other thing is to refer them quickly as well, especially if they've got any eye involvement, so don't hesitate to refer them. Certainly don't wait for the results of blood tests.
Thank you very much, Louise. Our next author is Dr. Alan Cohen. Alan, would you be so kind to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name's Alan Cohen. I was a GP in Mitcham for nearly 25 years, but for the last 3 or 4 years, I've been doing other things. I work 2 days a week at the Department of Health, advising on the Psychological Therapies Programme, IAPT, and 3 days a week I work at Broadmoor Hospital providing the physical health care for the patients there, a very varied and difficult group of patients.
You've been kind enough to do some other modules on mental health already for EKU, and just remind us which module you did for EKU 6.
EKU 6, I did dementia in people with a learning disability.
And how did you find that?
That was quite illuminating. It's not an area I know a great deal about. And having to read the guidelines carefully and extract the bits that were relevant to general practice was an interesting task, difficult in places, and interesting to identify the bits that were relevant to general practice was worthwhile and useful.
And what do you think were the most important bits that would you find applicable for general practice?
I think that there are the two or three major areas. One, the overall sense that dementia in people with learning disabilities is something that is managed by a multidisciplinary team. So for the GP, they need to know which of their patients have got a learning disability and how to contact the learning disability team in order to make sure their patients get assessed properly. And the second bit is to understand, is to know the common areas that can influence the presentation. So, for example, deafness or blindness will significantly affect how somebody presents with dementia who's got a learning disability. And these are some areas that a GP needs to be aware of because the interventions would clearly be different.
Dr. Alan Cohen, many thanks.
Next in our lineup of authors is Dr. Sue Martin, who worked on the vitamin D module for Essential Knowledge Updates. Sue, would you be so kind to introduce yourself?
Hi, yes, I'm Sue Martin. I work as a salaried GP in Oldham and spend a day a week as a GP with special interest in rheumatology.
And how did you find working on the vitamin D module for Essential Knowledge Updates?
Well, it was very interesting. This is a very topical subject at the moment, and it certainly raised a lot of questions where I'm working, particularly in rheumatology, because there's such a lack of current guidance as to what we should be looking for and what we should be treating.
And did working on the paper help you with that?
It did, yes. Obviously, vitamin D deficiency is becoming rapidly a public health issue, not just here, but in many other Western countries. And the question is, it's common, up to 50% of the people in our country are actually vitamin D deficient, but what do we do about it and is it relevant? Now, we know it causes osteomalacia and rickets, and it's obviously important in the development of osteoporosis. But is there anything else? If we've got a patient with low vitamin D who's got a normal bone profile, do we need to worry? The main paper that we looked at in this module basically summarised the evidence we've got that vitamin D may be important for a much bigger disease load than we've currently recognised. And in particular, it seems that low vitamin D is actually associated with increased all-cause mortality, but is also associated with an increased incidence of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, multiple sclerosis, and also some types of cancer, particularly bowel cancer. That there's some evidence that is linked with an increase in breast cancers and prostate cancers as well. Well, it's all very well having an observational link between these things, but does that mean that treating it actually reduces the disease burden? There certainly is some available out there now which shows that in certain instances, giving vitamin D supplement can reduce the disease incidence. Certainly with vitamin D supplementation in children, for example, there's some evidence coming through now that that can reduce the incidence of type 1 diabetes.
And what is the most important item that you took home or took to the practice with you?
Well, there were two or three I thought were key. First of all, that if you think someone's vitamin D deficient, they probably are and you don't need to check. And secondly, that if you're going to advise supplementation with vitamin D, then this should be lifelong. And it shouldn't be with calcium-containing tablets because the calcium is largely unnecessary and also it reduces palatability.
Dr. Sue Martin, many thanks.
Our next author is Thomas Round in London. Thomas, would you be so kind to introduce yourself?
I work in East London in Bromley Biobo practice, and I work there part-time. And last year I was an ST4, which means working part-time in clinical work and part-time as an academic GP. And I was working there at Barts and London Medical School. And I've only just got my CCT last August. So now I'm continuing working at the same practice in East London and working part-time as an academic fellow at King's College in primary care for the next 3 years doing research.
And which module did you prepare for EKU6?
So I did neuropathic pain management, looking mainly at the pharmacological management of neuropathic pain based on some new NICE guidance for non-specialists in primary and secondary care.
And how did you find that?
Well, I'd previously done another module on the last EKU, which was for syncope, which so that was my terms of reference doing one of these before, and that was I found that harder, obviously, because that was my first time, and that was a secondary care guideline. So this guideline was designed for primary and secondary care. So I found this a little bit easier to read through and to re-implement for what I think GPs need to know, kind of the core information.
And what would be the core facts or the morsels that you would take back to the practice and to your patients?
Yeah, so obviously it's a learning experience for me looking at this guideline. Also, I did obviously a bit of reading around the subjects, looking up the references, but also some other references that I found. So some key sort of things that I took home was that neuropathic pain is more common than you might think. It has a prevalence of about 1 to 2% in the general population. And a real important thing for me was, because where we work in East London, we have a large ethnic minority population, a lot of people with diabetes. In diabetics, it's estimated between 16 and 26% prevalence. So even just from that, I told the practice nurse, you know, there is research showing very high prevalence in diabetes, and that has led to a number of people being detected just from the nurses in diabetic checks, just asking when they're doing foot checks, do you have any kind of tingling, stabbing pain in your feet? And we've uncovered quite a few patients with that.
Are there any particular drugs that the guideline recommends?
Yeah, the main one would be amitriptyline, and that's for non-diabetic neuropathic pain first line. So I'd already used that. That was in my practice. I use that for things like migraines and things like that. So I felt fairly confident in that. Duloxetine was something which I hadn't particularly used much of, which is recommended first line for effectiveness and cost effectiveness for diabetic neuropathic pain.
Dr. Thomas Round, many thanks.
Our next author is reaching us all the way from Northern Ireland. Declan, would you be so kind to introduce yourself?
Certainly. I'm Declan Fox. I'm a part-time GP living out in the wilds in Northern Ireland. I do locums various places, do some mental health work, various things in that area, including cognitive therapy. And I do some writing. At the moment, most of the writing I've been doing has been with this EKU project.
And which module did you do for EKU6?
This time it was a recent guideline from the NICE organisation. It was on new onset chest pain of suspected cardiac origin.
And how did you find transferring the guidelines to a module?
Well, the main difficulty I had was that this is a subject on which I have a lot of knowledge and a lot of interest, a lot of experience, and I was very much aware that there was a big danger of my enthusiasm kind of running rampant, if you like, and I wanted to make sure that I got the most important points that would be of value to that mythical creature, the average GP, but let's say a GP who doesn't have a great passion for chest pain and really just needs some good guidelines, fairly brief, fairly concise, fairly useful to help them deal safely with those patients. So I had to be very careful about what I put in the finished product. And well, I am fairly happy with what I got down, but I felt that was probably the most difficult part of it, just making sure that I did not overdo it.
And what do you think are the most important parts in the guidelines?
Well, there's a good clinical approach. It basically tells you how you can make a fair good stab at judging whether it's cardiac or non-cardiac just from symptoms and history and so on, and a little bit of clinical examination. It takes into account that an ECG can be very useful if there's one available and you or somebody else is able to interpret it. But it also accepts that in some cases the ECG won't be available, and it basically says, okay, just get on with it on clinical grounds. So, I mean, I think that's a very important first point, that here we have in an authoritative guideline, we have some good guidance on how to suss out whether it's likely cardiac or likely non-cardiac, simply by using our eyes and ears and our hands. Second point is that there are some good algorithms in that guideline. There's one looking at the management of acute coronary syndrome. There's another one looking at the management of stable chest pain, thought to be angina. And it's very neat the way they distinguish those. And these algorithms, they're actually very, very nicely put together. And they're good documents for sticking up around the place for reference to. And then the third thing is that it does give a fair bit of information, particularly in the extended guideline, on the more detailed in-hospital investigation of these patients. Not necessary for most of us, but you know, we will from time to time have people coming back from the outpatients telling us, well, I had this, that and the other done, and you know, what does it all mean, doctor? So it's good to have that material to refer to in the extended guideline.
Declan, thank you very much for your help.
You're welcome.
So this is it, our first podcast for Essential Knowledge Updates. I would like to thank Dr. Sue Martin, Louise Newson, Alan Cohen, Declan Fox, and Thomas Round for their time and contribution to this recording, Dragana Milosevic and Katie Hopkins for their excellent administrative support. The music you heard at the beginning of the recording was a track called Matt's Chill by Matt Bianco from their recent album Hi-Fi Bossa Nova, and was used with their kind permission. The podcast was made using Audacity, a free and open audio editing tool. My name is Dirk Pilat. Goodbye.